Hi, this is Phil Lairness, sitting alongside my wife, Lily Lairness. As we travel through the third decade of the 21st century, it's good to know that the Midweek Drive and Midweek Drive Morning Editions continue to produce a minimum of 4 hours of weekly audio goodness on Siren Radio and southsidebroadcasting.podbean.com. Why do you have that glazed expression on your face, Lil?
Too many numbers in that announcement.
Well, back in the day, 60 used to be regarded as the new 40. And maybe it is, actually, depending on your quality of life and so on. But quality of life is certainly determined by the kind of exercise you might be engaging with. And recent research commissioned by David Lloyd Clubs suggests that the over 50s are much more active and adventurous, with over two-thirds of them currently having a specific fitness goal and over half feeling confident that they are likely to achieve that goal. So who can we actually ask to actually talk about this with authority and indeed appropriate sort of insight? Well, it's got to be the legendary BBC breakfast presenter extraordinaire and indeed fitness enthusiast and triathlete. It's Louise Minchin. How are you,
Lou? Oh my gosh, thank you so much. What a wonderful introduction. Yep, I'm over 50. I'm definitely in that 71% who have a specific fitness goal. And I'm, mostly confident that I will, if I set a goal, I will make it. So thank you very much for asking me to talk about it.
Well, I mean, this has got to be good news in general, because obviously quality of life is something we talk about in the abstract. But clearly, as we become more chronologically gifted, the range of qualities that we actually go through is important, isn't it?
Chronologically gifted. I love that. I'm about to become more chronologically gifted next week because I've got a birthday, another birthday in my 50s. Yeah, I think it's really important for me. And my message really is to everybody who's out there is, you know, it's never too late. You're never too old. And there's something that you can find exercise and sport wise, which will make you have a buzz. And for me, it's all about feeling confident. It's about feeling fitter, not so I look good. And that's echoed in the survey as well. We're not doing this a third of us so we look better. We're doing it so we feel better. But for me, it's not just feeling physically better. I know it really helps me mentally as well. Every single swim, bike session in the gym makes me feel a little bit better, more confident.
And that's really important when it comes to the personal input, because doing a fitness course because you want to actually do it for somebody else, although I can understand that to a certain extent, it's not really the best way to kind of keep that motivation going. If it's coming from within and you're doing it for your own personal well-being, that surely has got to be a much better policy to apply.
Yeah, I find that. And I feel, interesting in this survey as well. They said 32% of people my age are advising younger counterparts to prioritize well-being over how they look. And for me, that's it. It's all about my well-being. And it's kind of this strange virtuous circle that, you know, I do probably more exercise than most people, but I know I'm doing it because it makes me feel better, you know. And that's about resilience. It's about goal setting. It's about achieving. And, you know, I'm not doing, lots of people say, oh, you put us all to shame. I'm like, well, it's not about what, you know, it's not about that. It's about how it makes me feel. And I know it makes me feel better. Yesterday, I had a day where I didn't want to go to the gym. Luckily, got the 21-year-old here at the moment. She did want to go to the gym and we went together. And guess what? You know, after 20 minutes, we're both feeling much better. So it's important to do it for yourself, I think, and not, you know, it's how you feel, not how you look.
So Louise, what are your top tips for somebody who might be listening to this about saying, it's all well and good for Louise. I mean, she's a legendary broadcaster and triathlete. I can't cope with that league. What are the whole steps? Should it be baby steps? Should it be taking those first initial steps forward as opposed to saying, yeah, I'm going to go for the triathlete straight away?
Well, I mean, you can do either. You can do either. So I'm going to say this. I'm going to answer this in two ways. So the first step is the hardest step. And I always think it's not, in some ways, it's not couch to 5K, it's sofa to the front door. Yeah, that's what's really hard, you know, so make it easy for yourself. Make it a small thing when you're first starting. You know, maybe, I don't know, you want to go for, I don't know, maybe you're doing the school run and you could actually walk it, but you're not walking it. Build it into part of your life and build it with small steps. Maybe, you know, you're not running at the moment. I mean, I've done couch to 5K loads of times. That's a great way to start. Another great way is join a community, is go to a gym. You can go to a club like David Lloyd. Other clubs are available, but go to a club where there are, you know, there are classes. You might find a class that you like. And there'll be all, you know, in a sort of club, there'll be all sorts of different levels. So start slowly. That's one part. And then I'm going to answer it in completely the reverse way. Okay, so bear with me. Sometimes setting goals is brilliant. And I've set a whole series of what I thought at the time were unachievable goals, like going to do an extreme triathlon in Patagonia. That's enormously helpful. And it may be that that works for you, may not work for you, but you know, that definitely works for you. And then tell people about your goals. Let's say next year, my fingers crossed, I'm hoping to run the London Marathon. I've just told you that. Now I am accountable and you're all expecting me to run the London Marathon. So it's a mixture of, you know, big goals are really helpful. Also, I really appreciate that first step is the hardest. So try and build it into part of your life. This is an important part of your life. It's an hour in the day or 20 minutes in the day, which is for you. And I think if we can possibly fit that in, as you know, and it can be part of, I say, it could be part of your school run, it could be part of your commute to work or something. Make it part of your, because exercise is for me, it's not, it is part of my life, it's my lifestyle, it is part of me now. And it took a long time to get to that. But that's where I am. And, you know, without it, I would feel more, it sounds strange, but like more tired, more exhausted if I didn't do it.
Good habits, the key words to get into those good habits. And the benefits will be immeasurable. I've got to ask the question, Louise, yes. You're too young to really remember the Jane Fonda fitness era craze, etc. Can we look forward to a Louise Minchin series of fitness videos coming through in the not too distant future with leggings and all the rest of the bits and pieces?
Oh my gosh. I see lots of my erstwhile colleagues, etc., like the Frankie Bridges and Davina McCalls of this world. And God, they're doing an amazingly brilliant job. So that's fantastic. I've written a book this year. So that's what I've mostly been doing it. And it's about a lot of it. Every single chapter is a different adventure, as you might call it, whether it's walking in Wales or cycling to Paris or so. That's my version of it. It's going to be a book. Every book is dedicated to a different amazing woman who I think is amazing for different reasons. I've played rugby. I've been free diving. I've had an incredible time. So that's my version of the fitness video. And I'll do it as an audio book as well, so you can listen.
Wow. There could be nothing better from that sort of point of view. Okay, Louise, where can people find out further details about the David Lloyd survey?
Thank you so much. Yeah, so the book won't be out. I've got one out. It's called Dare to Try. Have a look at that. If you're interested in triathlon and starting, that's, you know, that really will take you through the baby steps as well. DavidLloyd.co.uk. Go there. You'll find information. You know, there's over 100 clubs in the UK, 100 clubs in the UK. So hopefully there'll be one near you. You'll find information there. Go look at it and find your tribe. Find the little thing that makes you tick and go for it. Because I just know, you know, my sitting here on this sofa. I am sitting on the sofa, but you know, I just know it makes me feel so much better about life.
Well, we've got two final questions, Louise. First of all, yes, as it's your debut today, have you had a reasonably interesting Zoomer with us on the Midweek Drive?
I love your Zoom background. What is it? It's absolutely fabulous.
That's actually the York Maze House of Corn Fusion. You're wondering, it's taken from a wonderful sort of York Maze thing. It means nothing to the listener, but it's just a location report we did earlier this year.
Well, I love that. And it's been lovely. Thank you.
And the next critical question is, can we prevail upon you to return? Will you someday come back to the Midweek Drive and more?
Of course, I would absolutely love to. Thank you very much indeed for your kind invitation.
Louise Minchin, broadcaster extraordinaire, triathlete and author extraordinaire as well. What the hey? Take care and good luck with the London Marathon.
Oh, gosh. Thanks.
You may be saying, I can't possibly afford to go on the internet. It's so expensive. I can't do it, especially if you're experientially enhanced and possibly over 50, over 55, even over 60, whatever. Maybe you can't afford not to go on the internet when you actually allow for the fact that you could conceivably save up to £1,000 a year simply by actually improving your computer skills. So who can we turn to actually address this particular facet of humanity? Well, TV presenter extraordinaire and, of course, the wonderful consumer champion that is Gloria Hunniford. How are you, Gloria?
I am very good, Alex. And you?
Well, great to connect with once again with you back on the Midweek Drive. Again, I've worked on several times where I thought we really need to put you together with our other regular correspondent, Angela Rippon. But, you know, that'd be too much goodness. So we'll just keep on going from this point of view. This research from Vodafone, of course, is particularly significant when you find that nearly half of British folk over 65 admit, quite understandably, they don't feel completely comfortable going online. And with the cost of living crisis, etc., it's understandable that there might be a bit of concern with respect to that.
I have to identify with that, really. And I think this research has been very valuable. And I'm going to be really truthful with you. I've had my computer and my website and everything for years and years, and I use it for my work and receive research information and everything else that goes with it. But I have been a bit reluctant, because obviously I'm well over 65, but I've been a bit reluctant. I don't know why, because I can type and everything, so I'm not afraid of the computer. So I can identify with the reluctance, really, because although I've had a computer and I've had a website for a very long time, for some reason or other, and I can't quantify it, I was a bit reluctant to get online. And then all of a sudden, during the lockdown, during that long time being at home more, I realized the value of it. Plus the fact that my grandchildren are now well grown up. They harangue me all the time. They call me Glow. So they say, Glow, for goodness sake, just get into the 21st century. And of course, they're right. And I have been, you know, stupidly reluctant. But when I read about this research that Vodafone had done over the over 65s, and you gave the figure there, nearly half of over 65s reluctant, I kind of thought this was just a great scheme, because although they've called it High Digital, which in my book is quite a grand title, but when you break it down, it's a step-by-step, easy learning program to learn new skills. And I was charmed by that, and I got a lot of confidence from that. And even if I have to ask one of my family or somebody I know, a friend who I know very well, to give me a bit of a hand, I like the idea of learning at my own pace.
I mean, clearly, this is something which does resonate with a lot of folk. Again, we have a regular monthly session with the wonderful actress Annette Andre, and she's also gone through this digital learning curve. Sometimes, admittedly, she's frustrated in terms of it does seem as though an awful lot of worlds coalesce in terms of the internet. Banking, finance, ordering groceries, all of those kind of things are actually there. It does become something which is more and more difficult to live without. And yet at the same time, taking that step forward, as we're demonstrating with this interview, 3 or 4 years ago, pre-COVID, I would have been in a studio, you would have been in a studio, we'd have been connecting via the telephone line. It's changed the way in which we carry out our everyday work. And in some instances, it's something which is not that difficult, despite all of the nightmares that are obviously put forward in terms of cybersecurity and so on and so forth.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, the more you realize as an individual, as I have, that the high street bank might be closing, the doctor wants me to get online to book an appointment, the dentist wants to do it all digitally, you realize that you really have to join in, because this is the way forward. And you're absolutely right when you say that the lockdown changed all our lives and our attitudes to life and how we're going to lead our life. And I think that businesses have had to adapt so much as well, that that's why we're seeing banks closing down, people saving money wherever they can. And I've also realized that, you know, as the day-to-day living costs are going up, and it's frightening, you know, you listen to the news and you think, when are we going to get £5,000 next year to pay an average energy bill? You think, how can that be? But I realized that you can shop around online for many deals. And sometimes I find even in the clothing side that the deals that they offer online are much better than even some of the high street shops that I would have gone to originally. And also for some people, state entitlements, you know, you can get government grants and things like that that you might not have thought of before, but you can find that on travel. Sometimes you can get really good advantages, but then you have to be careful that you're well covered by your insurance. And entertainment. I mean, a guy who drives me to work, he sometimes, because in London, you know, the cost of going to the West End is high, £100, £125 a ticket. Who can afford to take a family like that? But he tells me that he goes online and he can get tickets sometimes for 17, 19 quid for not for like the next night, it well in advance. So you can get entertainment as well at a good cost. So we can all save a bit of money, I think, by being adept at online.
So the benefits are quite clear. Things need to be addressed with respect to that. We'll still find folk, I'm sure, who have reservations. But if they want to find out further details about Vodafone and the High Digital scheme, what's the best place you would point them to, Gloria?
I hope you've got a pen handy, because the Vodafone one is a bit long. So it's vodafone.co.uk/newscentre/highdigital. And as I mentioned, High Digital breaks down to just easy step by step. But then the charity that's also teamed up with them is a very easy way of actually getting in touch, because it's independentage.org. And I like that phrase, independent age, because I like to feel independent at this age. And so that's really good. So there is help around. And of course, your family can always help you as well, or friends.
As we become more experientially enhanced, it's certainly the way forward from that point of view, which is very critical for the whole thing. Gloria, it's been fantastic connecting with your good self today via, of course, the internet and our various connections. So there we are.
You look fabulous with all your coloured rainbow colours behind you.
Have you had a reasonably interesting Zoomer with us on the programme is our penultimate question.
Yes, I have. It's so lovely to talk with you. And I'm very grateful for bringing this issue up, because I think a lot of people will be really interested.
Well, absolute delight. And who knows, Gloria, can we invite you again? Will you come back and join us once again in the not too distant future?
Alex. Anytime.
Gloria Hannaford, as ever, we salute you. Take care now.
Okay, bye-bye, Alex. All the very best. Thank you very much.
So to use the vernacular, saying something is dope means it's pretty darn good if you're using street language. Maybe dope actually has a connection with dopamine, which is the topic of the next feature we're looking at, because that's actually one of the sources of happiness. Apparently, recent research suggests that more than 1 in 10 adults agree that exercise brings them joy. 10% say that partaking in baking and cooking provides them with a healthy mood boost. And so on and so forth. So who can we actually turn to find out a bit more about how we can improve our dopamine and basically be happy in a world in which happiness seems to be a little bit more difficult to actually achieve? Well, it's got to be the legendary media medic, Dr. Karen Rajan. How are you, Karen?
I'm great, thank you. How are you?
I'm okay. Now, in terms of that, looking at this whole survey that comes through, thanks obviously to Capital One and the Happy Cafe that they're launching, etc., how deeply connected to the chemistry, the biochemistry of our minds, is the state of happiness?
I think it's very closely linked. I mean, the mind and body are linked, and specific to happiness, there are various chemicals that are involved in allowing us to be happy and regulating our mood. For example, dopamine, as you mentioned, are one of them. It's part of the reward circuitry of our brain. So completing tasks that can allow us to achieve some happiness. So going through your to-do list, for example. Serotonin, one of the alertness hormones, also regulates our mood. We can boost the levels of that by getting a shot of sunlight as soon as we wake up in the morning. And another thing would be endorphins, the natural mood elevators and painkillers that we can derive from exercise.
83% of UK adults say that they receive more happiness from the little things in life rather than grand gestures. Is that the equivalent to people's favourite Christmas presents actually being the packing of the box rather than the actual toy within?
Yeah, it might well be. I think that's the really important thing which resonated with me during that research, and just showing that material items in and of themselves may not derive or give you the most happiness. And actually little things, giving a compliment to someone or receiving a compliment from someone, going out for a walk in nature or interacting with friends and family, things which may be free or just seemingly innocuous may provide a great deal of happiness to you.
And the other thing that Capital One UK's research found is that more than half of our adults say they don't do enough to meet their happiness needs. Is that just because we're too busy to think about other our own happiness? We're too worried about other people's that we need to effectively sort of reschedule and take a step back in order to go forward?
Yeah, I see humans as having a sort of figurative tank. And that's, you know, and when it's full, we're very happy. And when it's empty, we're, you know, tired or upset or frustrated. And I think there are a lot of things that we do that keeps us happy. But equally, there are a lot of things which can cause there to be a hole in the tank and cause our happiness to leak out. You know, stresses of our jobs, poor sleep, lack of exercise, not getting a range in our diet, not interacting with other people. So although we might do things which make us happy, we're equally not accounting for the things which might be draining our happiness, like the things I mentioned. So although doing things which encourage happiness is good, it's also to be mindful of things which are actually sucking away any happiness as well.
There's, of course, the whole notion of treats, terrible results, eating all that sugar. People might sort of say, well, it's just a guilty pleasure. It's all I've actually got. I think one needs to be mindful, perhaps, of the short-term solutions that might seem great, but ultimately cause long-term unhappiness.
Yeah, I think, you know, there's a lot of demonization of certain foods like crisps or chocolates or sweets, and some people might use them as a crutch when they're in a low mood. But actually, if you enjoy the odd bar of chocolate or a donut or whatever, I think stressing about diets can actually have a negative impact. You know, overly stressing about things will actually have a negative impact on about food. And, you know, eating the half packet of Pringles or a box of chocolates, you know, now and then is going to be less of an impact on your health than constantly worrying about what you're doing. And I think the stress is one of the biggest killers of our mood.
You're in a profession, Dr. Rajan, as a medic, which is prone to huge levels of stress and anxiety and so on. What do you do to actually keep happy at the end of the day?
Yeah, it's a good question. And I think it's important to note that we can't be happy all the time. I think that's an unreasonable expectation. But there are things we can do to keep us in balance, let's say. And occasionally that will lift us through to a happy state as well. And I like to do things which can just help me to relax, and I associate relaxation with a state of happiness. So that's on the drive home after a shift, putting on some really nice music on my drive home, listening to a podcast, coming home and being with my dog or taking him out for a brief walk, or just, you know, acting as a sort of catharsis and going to the gym and doing a gym workout for half an hour or 40 minutes. So simple things which are free to me and I can just do. I know I've got the capabilities to do that anytime, and that just gives me a little boost of happiness or relaxation.
Going to one's internal happy place, one might say. Speaking of happy places, what about the happy cafe? Or is it the happy cafe?
Yeah.
In terms of what is it trying to achieve? Is it a cafe you can have a frappe, for instance?
Well, I think that's the rhyming there. It's happy, as in it keeps you happy, but obviously it gives you frappes, lattes, all the other A's that you need. And in addition to all of that, it gives you access to laughing yoga, which I never heard about before, singing baristas, and there's even a compliment station where someone comes up to you and tells you something nice about yourself. And all of this is free. And it's over the next couple of days in London, all of these things are available and all of these multi-sensory ways to trigger your happiness at the Happy Cafe in London.
So do you think that this could be rolled out across the nation? Do you feel it could be a sign of things to come, that singing baristas could be the way forward with the coming winter fuel crisis?
I think, yeah, someone needs to pioneer a means to improve the nation's happiness, and having little happiness pop-ups that can give you your daily dose of happy chemicals might be the way to go.
And where can people find out further information about what we've been discussing today, Dr. Rajan?
So you can find out all about the science of happiness that Capital One has done and more about the Happy Cafe on the Capital One blog.
Dr. Karen Rajan, media medic, huge thanks. And needless to say, we have to finish with those two words: be happy.
Indeed. Thank you very much.
So, wine and ice. Ice and wine. Huge debate, effectively, arising from the whole concept of two-thirds of British people apparently have never, ever thought about putting ice in a glass of rosé. Well, certainly to address this particular aspect, we need to bring in an expert. And who better than a master of wine sommelier extraordinaire? Of course, it's the fabulous Susie Barry. How are you, Susie?
I'm fine, Alex. Very good.
Excellent. Now, straight to the point, do you put or have you ever put ice in wine?
I have, Alex, and I am not ashamed to admit it. I think, you know, that the whole point, wine is totally about enjoyment, so you need to get the best out of your glass of wine. And rosé, we often drink in the summer, obviously, we drink in the heat, we drink outside. You don't want it to be warm. So yes, it might not be perfect putting ice in it, but I think that's way better than drinking it too warm.
It's a different form of alcohol, but does this also have resonances with the classic debate of Americans preferring their beer cold, whereas the British male in particular prefers warm beer?
Oh, I don't know. I don't think we can put rosé and beer together.
Right. Yeah. No.
I think we're talking about British males probably in very cold weather in the winter wanting something that's tasty and after a hard day's work probably. I think rosé is way more about sitting out in the sunshine on a terrace maybe, you know, somewhere lovely, and warm, and you just want a cool drink. So, you know, whether I don't think it's a preference in terms of a national sort of preference or a temperature preference as such. It's more about what's appropriate for the given circumstances.
Well, we certainly don't want to start any kind of confrontation going in this particular aspect. But this research from Majestic, of course, does actually point to a slight gender split, with men feeling more strongly against adding ice to their glass of rosé. 34%, so over a third, felt it was unsophisticated. Only 22% of women actually thought that. 19% of men also said they judged other people for putting ice in their wine. That's a bit problematic, isn't it? If you actually have that issue of, you know, you've asked for ice in your wine and suddenly, ooh, there are frowning eyebrows are being raised and you're suddenly sort of positioned as a wine pariah.
It's interesting, isn't it, Alex? Because I think that number goes down to 8% for women who would judge other people for doing it, which is an interesting one. I don't know why that is, but I think, you know, I would never judge anybody genuinely for drinking their wine the way they want to drink it. I might not agree with it. I might not want to do it myself, but seriously, wine is really about enjoyment, and you've got to drink it the way that it suits you.
Mm. I mean, we again clearly are aware of whiskey on the rocks, scotch on the rocks, and other sort of elements relating to that. Does this mean that rosé on the rocks could well be a drink that could gain in popularity in the 21st century?
I think you've just coined a phrase there then, or branded rosé on the rocks. It's brilliant. I don't think it's something to promote, if you like. I think it's a great idea because, like I say, nobody wants to drink warm rosé. There's nothing worse. The problem, obviously, as soon as you add ice, is you are going to dilute the flavour, and you don't really want to do that. I think the more complex your wine is, the less you want to start messing around with the flavour. If it's a nice, simple, maybe a bit more cheap and cheerful style of rosé, yes, absolutely. Let's get a couple of cubes of ice in if that's going to make it a more palatable drink. You know, it's not going to allow it to be warm. But I wouldn't promote it, because I don't think you're going to get a better glass of rosé by sticking ice in it. You're just going to make it good if the weather's too warm.
So from your own perspective, as, let's face it, a mistress of wine, let's be gender specific here from that point of view.
Yeah. still a master.
Yeah, there we are. Is this something where you feel it's going to echo through the winter months as well? I mean, I can see people possibly with their energy bills going through the roof, possibly having to turn to their last bottle of rosé to actually at least keep them moderately warm. So ice then wouldn't happen. Is this strictly a summer month debate?
I think it probably is. You know, rosé, I would never say it's a bit like the dogs and Christmas. I would say rosé is never only for summer. But I think, you know, you absolutely drink rosé throughout the year. It's a beautiful drink, but there are different styles of rosé. And I think when you move towards the winter months, you're probably going for the slightly bigger, slightly probably more complex rosés, more wintry rosés. And, you know, it's cold. You don't need to stick the ice in those at all. You know, it's as you say, it's sort of, you are going to serve them cold, but it's going to warm you up, if you like. And you're right, with energy bills, we need something to cheer us up, frankly, don't we?
Well, that could be one of the sort of lines that could be coming across the whole system, but that's for another issue. If we talk about, obviously, drinking responsibly, we'd clearly say do that in all instances. What would, in your own viewpoint, Susie, be the best way to take a glass of rosé? Let's say it is rosé with added ice, rosé on the rocks. Would it be a gentle sip? Would it be a gulp? Is there a sort of formal way of actually consuming the wine?
The thing I would definitely say is don't pour too much, because what you really want is, you don't want the ice to sort of melt any more than it needs to. So if you have a smaller glass of rosé with a cube of ice in, you are going to get through it before the ice has melted into the rosé far more quickly than if you have a large glass where the ice sits in it for quite a long time. So I would say, you know, a smaller pour, you can sip or slurp however you wish. That's entirely up to you. I don't think a big gulp of wine, you ever get the best out of it. But, you know, whatever suits you.
Well, there we are, Susie Barry, clearly actually putting the whole protocols of the issue to bed. And where, Susie, can people find out further details about this majestic research?
Yeah, the majestic. If you can go onto the majestic website, majestic.co.uk, or I think the best way is just to pop into store. You know, they're all over the country. Pop into store, talk to the guys in there. They're always hugely knowledgeable, and they can also point you in the direction of some lovely rosés, probably even a nice magnum of rosé, which is always quite fun to take to a party.
Indeed, and not to be consumed all at once by the same individual, just saying, very important. And no matter how much you might be worried about the energy
That's
bills.
That's the point of a party, isn't it? It's for sharing.
Yeah, exactly. Susie Barry, wine expert extraordinaire, huge thanks, and happy wine drinking, Susie.
And to you, Alex.
December day, I saw her on the highway. I said, I'm headed west. She said, you're going my way. Then she got in with me, somewhere in Tennessee. She snuggled up close to me. She kissed me and then she said, I want you to take me to the California line. Get back where the bright sun shines. And then she turned my head around like California wine. And then she smiled at me and put her hand in mine and poured me a cup of wine, sweet California wine. She said she thumbed all day from Wheeling, West Virginia. She said, I'll make a trade for all the love that's in ya. I can sit and talk to you. We'll share a cup of wine or two, and I can be good to you. She kissed me and then she said, I want you to take me to the California line. She said, I've got to get back where the bright sun shines. And then she turned my head around like California wine. Then she smiled at me and put her hand in mine and poured another cup of wine, sweet California wine. Chased a fading sun and watched the shadows fall in. And as we sipped the wine, I heard California calling. Then she whispered in my ear, and it became very clear. I shifted into second gear. I kissed her and then I said, I'm gonna take you to the California line. Said we've got to get back where the bright sun shines. And then she turned my head around like California wine. And then she smiled at me and put her hand in mine and poured another cup of wine, sweet California wine.
So when should you begin to cut those apron strings? When should you actually push the fledgling out of the nest and hopefully see that they fly? How can they actually be more independent? When we're talking about independence, of course, and youngsters, there are differences in terms of opinions. According to NatWest Rooster Money, more than half of parents think that their children should start gaining more independence by the age of 12, certainly, with a little under a third believing that actually 10 is the time when they should start getting more independent and so on. So to address this particular fact, who better than our ace psychologist, Linda Papadopoulos? How are you, Linda?
I'm great. How are you?
Oh, great to connect with you, good self, as ever. And fascinated by this particular research, which Rooster Money have actually come up with, in terms of how children can feel more independent, really. And this isn't a case of saying, right, we're abandoning you, but it's very much a case of ensuring that they are, I suppose, engaging with the world out there, isn't it?
Yeah. So, for me, this is a story about balance, right? Balancing, wanting to kind of parent your kids and keep them safe, but at the same time, wanting to kind of, instill that independence, getting them out of their comfort zone, getting yourself as a parent out of that comfort zone. Because I think, our go-to place as a parent is to kind of just, mother them or father them as much as we can. But actually, the only way to nurture them to become more confident and self-sufficient is to take those steps out of their comfort zone. And that's what came out of this research.
It's fascinating to see the top 10 things that would make children themselves feel more independent. And although there are things such as being responsible for remembering to do my homework or their homework, getting ready for school themselves, being able to go on to sleepovers or stay the night away from home, actually number one is walking to school without a parent or guardian, and getting transport without a parent or guardian comes at number two. That obviously must be quite a rite of passage, it would seem.
I think so. And I think there's something there around that kind of moving from primary school to secondary school. It is that rite of passage. To me, what was really interesting as well is that it came up high on a parent's list. It was number two on the parent's list of things that would make their child feel more independent, which was interesting. Look, I think it's something that both parents and kids want, but I think the problem comes around how do you feel like you're doing this in a staged way, right? So you don't kind of go from, never letting your child walk outside the door to letting them take public transport the next day. It's about breaking it down. And that's true of everything, right? Mm. So whether it's getting a part-time job or managing how they spend their money, these are the conversations you need to have kind of, right from the start, and then increasingly actually put those into practice.
I can certainly understand from the children's perspective, being left at home alone might be a line of independence, making their own lunches. But I can see some challenges in terms of joining social media and having their own social media accounts and having a boyfriend or girlfriend. Maybe that's the traditionalist that's coming out here, but I can see a lot of potential family conflicts with respect to those issues.
I think there probably will be, but I think one of the big ones that I think we spent a lot of time looking at as well was how do you kind of gain this notion of taking care of your future self, right? So with regards especially to kind of financial literacy, we know that that's a conversation that we're all speaking about now as adults, but this is something that I think is going to be in the ether for the next little while. Kids are going to hear about it. So how do you speak to your child about what is saving? What is delayed gratification? What is spending? How are your chores related to, whether or not you get money? And I think those conversations are going to be integral, especially given what's going on in the ether right now.
It's intriguing that in terms of the elements that would make parents feel their child is being more independent, as you mentioned, the finance does come in there. Not mentioned, of course, by the children's perspective, but as far as parents are concerned, managing how their children spend and save their money, getting a part-time job, these are all things which some might say, are you kind of putting the whole capitalistic theme to the fore here? Or is it just a case of, no, we're just prepping the children for what life is going to be like when they need to earn their own pennies and cents?
I think it's irresponsible not to speak to your children about saving and spending. I think it's critical, right? It's to a large extent, we know that that idea of self-sufficiency comes from knowing what, you know, resources I have and how to use them. And the worry is if you don't speak to kids about this, then when it comes time to, you know, to have to kind of take care of their money, that they're not able to think about it in the right way. Look, money is this kind of amorphous, intangible thing, but getting kids to think about it in terms of, well, how much time, you know, did it take to make this? What, you know, what can I exchange it for? And this should start off, I would say, early on. I think most parents have used star charts with their kids. And of course, that's nothing to do with money, but it's the same principle. It's around the idea that, you know, I do certain things that are expected of me. I gain these rewards, whether it's extra bedtime stories or extra playtime. And through that, I have this sense of delayed gratification, which we know is integral for kind of well-being and proper development. So I think it's those conversations that you have as a youngster, you know, very early on, and then they're able to move forward with them. And I think the other thing that I think is critical here as well, we're increasingly moving to a cashless society. We know that if you pay with cash, you feel the bite, right? So you're more likely to be frugal. When it's electronic, you don't tend to feel it as much. So getting on an app, understanding that you need to kind of feel that bite when you pay, so you're not being exploited, you're not spending your money on things that you don't need, I think is critical too.
I was going to go on to the cashless society, because I'm sure there are many parents, and probably more likely grandparents these days, who would say, yes, well, it's all very well with respect to cards and with respect to mobile phones and so on. But if you actually give the impression that, well, money is something you actually get when you put your card into a hole in the wall and then cash comes out, that is just as bad as the illusion that, well, it's an intangible quantity. And as you said, that whole notion of receiving physical payment, certainly in the 21st century, seems to be something which we are heading away from. So dealing with that abstract concept from a psychological perspective, Linda, presumably it is important. Otherwise, people might say, well, money, it's just like the tooth fairy. It's just, you know, not real at all.
Absolutely. So, you know, I think these conversations, they need to be had, right? This is about, in many ways, becoming good at the things that are important at life, like being able to save, like being able to spend responsibly, like being able to not react on impulses. We know this kind of, you know, marketeers now have resources to get us to think about buying stuff and wanting stuff in ways that, you know, like you said, our grandparents never saw. So any way you can inoculate your kids against this, the better.
Just like to point out, for the benefit of any very young listeners, that I didn't say the tooth fairy wasn't actually real there. There might be some reality where the tooth fairy actually does have tangible evidence. But the key point I want to move on to, Linda, is how do we actually deal with this? And what advice do you actually have for both parents and children when it comes to that whole issue of financial education?
I think the first thing that I would say is start talking about the notion of spending early. And again, I would start this with a star chart where you kind of decide with your child, you know, when they're 3 or 4 or 5, what things you want from them, whether it's finishing all their vegetables or, you know, being able to, you know, to do something you ask them to do. And then you give them a little star. And then at the end of the week, they can exchange it, not for monetary things, but for things like extra reading at night or playtime or whatever the case may be. This is a great way of getting them to think about the notion that I have a sense of volition over how I kind of navigate through life and what I get. Then as they get older and you're able to speak about the value of things, how much things cost, it's a great idea to kind of get them to think about either this or that, right? We can't have everything we see. There's a reason for that. Probably a good idea to think about what I need. Am I being manipulated into wanting something? Do I really want it? So start having those more nuanced discussions. And then I would say getting them something like, you know, the NatWest Rooster Money app is great. It has features like, you know, the virtual pocket money tracker, so they can see that they, you know, they've saved some of their birthday money, what they're going to spend it on. It, you know, it has things like a chore manager. So it allows kids to start thinking more deeply around these issues. And hopefully by the time they head off to university, they're able to kind of manage their money, which is a very important life skill.
maybe we'll actually be heading to a society of bartering or indeed exchanges for other aspects. Or maybe we'll find something else to actually work through in the system. But and for the benefit of people who wish to find out further details about this Fabulous Rooster Money app, which was indeed voted best children's pocket money app in the MoneyNet Awards 2021, and indeed best kids spending app in the Finder Banking Innovation Awards of 2020, where would you point people, Linda? Where should they go?
If they Google NatWest Rooster Money, they will get lots of information, both on the research that we did and on the app itself.
Linda Papadopoulos, a psychologist extraordinaire. Always a delight to feature your good self. Keep on keeping on, and we'll speak again soon, no doubt.
Thank you so much. Great to chat.
What would you think if I sang out a tune? Would you stand up and walk out on me? Lend me your ears and I'll sing you a song, and I'll try not to sing out of key. Oh, I get by with a little help from my friends. I get high with a little help from my friends. Gonna try with a little help from my friends. What do I do when my love is away? Does it worry you to be alone? How do I feel by the end of the day? Are you sad because you're on your own? No, I get by with a little help from my friends. Get high with a little help from my friends. Gonna try with a little help from my friends. Do you? When you turn out the light, I can't tell you, but I know it's mine. Oh, I get by with a little help from my friends. Get high with a little help from my friends. Oh, I'm gonna try with a little help from my friends. Do you need anybody? I just need someone to love. Could it be? I want somebody to love. Oh, I get by with a little help from my friends. Gonna try with a little help from my friends. Oh, I get high with a little help from my friends. Yes, I get by with a little help from my friends. With a little help from my friends.
With a little help from my friends, as the Beatles and indeed Joe Cocker once said. And you need friends. After all, you can choose your friends, you can't choose your family, and other such cliches. Why is it we need to keep investing in friendship? Well, let's find out by talking to, as we celebrate the joys of Friendship Month, a clinical psychologist extraordinaire, Dr. Jennifer Wilde. How are you, Jennifer?
Hi, I'm well. Hi, Alex.
Excellent. So why is it so important? I mean, we might sort of on an intrinsic, intuitive level appreciate why friendship is important, but just from a psychological perspective, why is it important to feel as though we have friends?
Friendship is incredibly important for our well-being and mental health. So we've done quite a bit of research at the University of Oxford where we've looked at what we call protective factors. So when we go through something difficult, what are the factors that protect us from developing difficulties like post-traumatic stress or depression or even bereavement difficulties? And what we've discovered is that people who have what we call a good social support network, so they're able to lean on friends during tough times, are much less likely to develop debilitating stress reactions like post-traumatic stress or depression. And if they go through a bereavement, they're much more able to move forward with the loss of a loved one if they have friends and can lean on friends.
Now, we also have with us the Chief Executive Officer of the Oddfellows Friendly Society. That's Jane Nelson. I mean, you commissioned this research. Jane, were you surprised by the findings? Perhaps we don't actually have Jane. We don't actually. Jennifer, again, you've had a look at the research. What were your thoughts? I mean, were you surprised from your own perspective?
I'm not surprised by the findings. So 84% of people in the East Midlands believe it's important to invest time in maintaining friendships. I think that's spot on, and that concurs with the research we're conducting at the University of Oxford. There are some worries about being able to maintain friendships with the rising cost of living. And that's where the not-for-profit friendly society Oddfellows comes in. They have organized various low-cost or free events for people to meet up and maintain their friendships throughout Friendship Month. And you can find out more about these low-cost events at www.friendshipmonth.com.
Sometimes people find it difficult to open up to friends. Two-thirds apparently say they're happy to talk to friends about how they're feeling. That still leaves a third of us who would say, I'm not too sure about this. Do you think that something like Friendship Month can actually help during September, that bridge building that we actually need when we do find we need somebody to lean on?
I think Friendship Month will help to support that. I also suggest that people take a risk and reach out and share something they've been concerned about, or maybe they feel a bit embarrassed about, with a friend to discover how people really react, how their friend is likely to react. So often we over-exaggerate kind of negative reactions in our mind's eye, but we actually don't discover how people will really respond unless we share with them. So it's a great time to experiment with and get accurate information, is to take that risk to discover, well, how will my friend respond if I share this difficulty? And it can also help if you have some concerns about how your friend will respond, to be clear about what you need. So you could say, you know, I have something difficult to share. What I really need is for you to listen and maybe offer a helping hand. So being clear about what you need can also be really helpful when you're sharing with a friend.
With the cost of living crisis and all of the other issues that are actually all around us, it probably seems even more important to actually have that connection with humanity. And do you feel that what Oddfellows are actually doing in terms of actually running hundreds of free or inexpensive taster social events, such as walks, talks, lunches and coffee mornings, is that an important side, Jennifer? Because this is something which is there. It's not going to cost the earth. It is something which we can actually use just to make that human connection.
It's brilliant. You know, being able to have these free events or low cost events in order to be able to meet up and maintain friendships or meet new friends is incredibly important, and fits with what the research shows in terms of protecting our mental health and ensuring that we stay well when we face tough times with the rising cost of living.
In the world of academia, of course, we know it can be a lonely profession at times, but we reach out through conferences, through calls, through various other bits and pieces. My question basically is, do we have a situation, Jennifer, where it doesn't matter what your particular stage of employment happens to be in society, friendship is important?
It doesn't matter what you do for a living, whether you're unemployed or employed. Friends are really important for maintaining mental health and well-being.
And I'm not sure whether we have actually got Jane Nelson back. Jane, are you back with us? Very briefly for a couple of minutes.
I am.
Fantastic.
Back, Alex,
this,
yes.
This is good. We've spoken extensively about National Friendships Month, etc. Just very briefly, Jane, could you just explain why this mission was developed from Oddfellows to actually rebuild social confidence and indeed help people in later life to make new friends? What was the purpose of it?
The original purpose when we started Friendship Month back in 2010 was give a real purpose and a real focus to friendship because it's so important. I think this year Friendship Month is even more important with the cost of living increase, as Jennifer said, and we have got so many low cost or free events going on around the country. But I think the important thing is that I think the lockdown gave us focus in terms of we realised how much we valued our friends and family. And I think this gives us the opportunity now, as we're coming out of that, to actually really enjoy spending time with each other, making new friends, and actually feeling the mental health benefits that come with being in that warm, fuzzy surrounding when you've got friends around you and you're enjoying yourselves.
Absolutely. And of course, the web address is friendshipmonth.com, presumably the best one to go to. Or if you want to find out more about Oddfellows, oddfellows.co.uk.
Absolutely. Or 0800 028 1810.
Jane Nelson, Chief Executive Officer of the Oddfellows Friendly Society, and clinical psychologist extraordinaire, Dr. Jennifer Wilde. Huge thanks. And keep on being friendly.
Thanks, Alex.
Thanks, Alex.
Old friends, old friends, sat on their park bench like bookends, a newspaper blown through the grass falls on the round toes of the high shoes of the old friends. Old friends, winter companions, the old men, lost in their overcoats, waiting for the sunset. The sounds of the city sifting through trees settle like dust on the shoulders of the old friends. Years from today, sharing a park bench quietly. How terribly strange to be 70. Old friends, memory brushes the same years, silently sharing the same.